We are very pleased to have with us Professor Rick Wolf to update us on where we are in this ongoing global capitalist crisis. Austerity has appeared in the titles of many articles on the global economic crisis. What is it? Rick Wolf writes in his article titled Austerity, Why and For Whom? That the efforts to broaden the recovery beyond 1 year have failed, and that failure has cost Washington trillions in borrowed funds from lenders. Those lenders now demand guarantees that those loans will be repaid to them with interest. The guarantee demanded by lenders is, quote, austerity. To collect this austerity, the bank lenders want governments to raise taxes or cut government spending, or both. That's an extreme burden imposed on the global economy. Rick asks, why not collect austerity from nonprofit multinational corporations, churches, and private institutions that are already tax exempt? Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a few weeks since you've been on, and today we're going to talk about the subject of austerity. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, austerity is a term to describe what is basically a very simple thing. Over the last 3 years, as the crisis engulfed all of the world, pretty much, country after country, government after government, was asked by their banks, their insurance companies, many of their larger corporations, to rescue them from imminent collapse. It started late in 2007, accelerated across 2008 and into early 2009. And everywhere, because of the nice relationship between finance and government, the governments complied with this request and spent literally trillions, with a T, to bail out all these institutions. Now, when a government has to spend suddenly so much more money, and we're not just talking about the United States government, which borrowed the most to do this, but all governments, they really have three ways to raise the money. They can print the money, but that's dangerous for inflation and for the value of the currency. They can tax their people, but that's politically dangerous and means the government that did that wouldn't be there very long. Or they have the third option, which is to borrow the money. And that's what all these governments suddenly did to enormous amounts of money. We've never seen that in the world economy before, such a surge of borrowing across the board.
When you say borrow, the way they borrow is they, how do they borrow it?
They issue what are called government bonds, treasury bonds in this country, and other government debt, it's called in general. And they hope somebody out there lends them the money, buys these pieces of paper, which in effect is lending them money for a specified length of time. The urgency of the impending crisis of capitalism, the second major collapse of capitalism in 75 years, was so intense, the terror in the ranks of business was so complete, that nobody stopped to worry, think about, just get the government, save us, give us lots of money, lend us lots of money, take toxic assets off our books by buying them from us, and so on. And nobody worried much about the government borrowing. So now we come full circle. Now, suddenly, with governments borrowing so much and being often governments that have already been borrowing for a long time, like the United States, suddenly the creditors, all the people who lend to the government, are beginning to get as nervous about their loans to governments as, for example, they were about subprime borrowers in the mortgage business not so long ago. And so the creditors have been going to the governments and saying, you know, we're not going to lend you much more money because you look like a government that's in such debt that your people may make you unable to pay it back. And we don't want to be stuck with the debt of a country that is in that situation. And so we're going to make a demand on you. We're not going to give you any new debt, and we're not even going to roll over, renew the debts that are outstanding that come due all the time, which would plunge these societies into collapse because they depend on credit and have become so over the last 25 years. So they really had these governments pretty much over a barrel.
When you say that, who is the we again?
The creditors, the people who lend. And I'll come to who they are a little bit later.
Good.
Anyway, they went to the governments and they said, okay, you're in deep doo-doo if you don't do the following. You either have to raise taxes on your people and put that money in a special account, which will only be used to pay us interest and pay back our principal. Or you cut your programs, your public services, and save that money and put it into the same special account to make sure. And if you don't do that, and if that money isn't there and visible to us in that account to pay us back, then it's end time for your debt. This terrifies any government, because if creditors actually stopped, didn't renew debt, then literally they would stop having to be able to pay their teachers, their school, their policemen, their social programs and everything else, or they would come in with a tax bill on their population. So whether it's raising taxes or cutting programs, the name for what we call the government response to the demand of its creditors is austerity. It's imposing on a society a severe regimen of rising taxes and or cut government spending to please and satisfy creditors.
But let me ask you, I understand this, to please the creditors so they can basically pay their debt that the creditors have in their possession, the debts.
That's right.
But the creditors, are they in that strong position? Why can't the country just say, we'll go bankrupt?
They could.
But then they're finished, right?
Well, not that they're finished. Mm-hmm. Then they have declared war. That's the classic act of war between debtor and creditor. Mm-hmm. Sure, I'll give you an example. One of the governments that creditors have been really harsh with is the government of Greece. That's why Greece is in such trouble. That's why all public employees in Greece last month saw their wages cut between 15 and 20% with a promise of a further cut in October. That's why there are general strikes in Greece almost every other week now. There's a confrontation, and the pressure from the masses below includes a demand, for example, supported by the Communist Party of Greece, which is an important political party in that country, demanding default, demanding withdrawal from the European Union, and demanding we don't pay.
They're saying to the government, default on the bonds because we don't want to be put into a situation of having our wages cut and austerity.
Right. And, the way they put it, which Americans might appreciate more, is to impose austerity on the mass of people. And let's be clear, that's what's being done in the United States, too. To impose on the mass of people an austerity, a combination of rising taxes and cut services, is basically to arrange to bail out capitalism's failure by hurting the mass of people. The cost of this crisis is in this way, through austerity, being shifted from the enterprises that brought it to us to the people who are going to be made to pay. And the austerity is just this indirect way of arranging that.
Critical point.
But isn't some form of austerity the responsibility of the borrower?
Good. The question is, when you do an austerity, when you make the decision, as Michael said, is an open matter. You can default, just as individuals can go bankrupt or companies can go bankrupt and not pay their debts as one way out. But putting that aside for the minute, assume you're going to want to keep your creditors happy. Now the question is, when you raise taxes and you cut services, taxes on whom? Services for whom? Let me give you an example here drawn from the United States so Americans can understand it better. We have a policy in the United States that says if you are a private university and you have lots of wealth, no matter how much wealth you have, you do not pay any taxes on it. You do not pay to the federal government any income tax. You do not pay to the state government any processing tax, sales tax, anything else. And very important to the communities in which you live, you pay no property tax. I'll give you an example, Yale University, New Haven. A multi-billion dollar corporation with multi-billion dollars of annual income pays no taxes. If we're going to have an austerity in the United States, here's a question. At a time of national crisis, of an economic emergency, rather than increasing the taxes of the average person, why don't we do what we probably should have done long ago and really go through our tax structure and say, let's tax the people who've been having a holiday on taxes for a long time, but now, in this moment of crisis, is a reasonable time to go after them. Same issue in Greece.
I'd prefer if you would tax the churches and the temples.
Absolutely. The religious institutions. always you could have a break point. In other words, smaller institutions with a little bit of money are exempted the way we do that in many tax structures. So small universities that are basically paying as they go would not be hit. But we're talking about the Harvards and the Yales and the Princetons that are sitting on billions and billions of assets and so on. And yes, this would be the services. What services are going to be cut? For example, an austerity here in the United States could be handled by having money put aside for creditors by, say, ending the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan or reducing debt. There's a way. Cutting services that are not necessary in all kinds of ways. That's a political struggle, of course. So
instead, for our listeners here, instead what they plan to do is they're cutting certain subway lines altogether in New York.
Absolutely,
they're
already have.
Cutting post office possible
senior
delivery.
Senior homes.
The delivery on Saturdays may not be existent anymore. I went to
libraries.
A post office the other day, no more pickups after 4 o'clock. I mean, it's already going in a real way.
Yeah.
The reason in Europe, most services delivered to people and most taxes are done by the central government. They're relatively smaller countries. In our country, it's very confusing for people because we have three separate tax systems, federal, state, and local. So the federal government is not yet in a massive austerity program, but do look already what was done to the unemployment extension benefits over the last few weeks. There's already this notion we have to cut back. We have to cut back on our deficits. And that's all that austerity talk. But we already have austerity at the local and state levels. Savage austerities. Okay. To anyone who's wondering, take a look at California. They're laying off thousands and thousands of state employees, cutting services left and right. And that's the norm across the United States, and it is increasingly the norm in city and town governments with their tax process.
I mean, what I'm getting from you is really clearly, though, is what's happening is after capitalism goes into crisis and the money gets loaned to the capitalists, then they shift who's going to pay for
Absolutely.
That onto the backs of working people. That's one. And secondly, they're doing it through an austerity that is going again after those same people rather than austerity in the military budget or
multinational corporations.
Well, I can make it even more stark for you, this shifting of the process. There are two indices that will and should upset your listeners. First, every year there's something called a World Wealth Report. It is produced by Merrill Lynch Corporation together with a research outfit called Capgemini. Very famous, used all over the world. And what it does is it measures the development of what are called high net worth individuals. Those are individuals around the world, the whole planet, who have above a certain number of millions of dollars worth of income and or assets. They very proudly released their report recently. They very proudly show that in 2009, a disaster year for the world economy, the number of these individuals rose and their average wealth rose 17%. So for people at the top, the economic crisis was no crisis at all. That's one measure. The second measure is the stock market had a quote-unquote recovery over most of the last year. It's no longer happening, but it did for a while, that recouped about a half, more or less, of the losses. So for people who had enough stocks, which is a very minority of Americans, they got at least some of their wealth that they lost back. So we're talking about an austerity imposed on a mass of people, while those closest to the authorities and decision makers who brought us this crisis are the ones who have relatively done real well. One last measure. Try to think of this if you can stand it. The banks of the United States and the world are among the most important creditors to governments. They are the buyers of government debt. So now follow the bouncing ball. The bankers produce a crisis. The government bails them out. The government borrows from them to bail them out, and now the government is imposing an austerity on everybody else to make sure they pay back the banks who have lent them the money that the banks were bailed out with. If you understand that, you understand what it means to say that modern capitalism is a system designed for the benefits of a very few people and is even well enough organized that during a crisis, that situation doesn't change.
So, doesn't sound great. What do we do
practically
next? What happens?
Well, let's go back. You've already told Michael's question before was the right one. One option is to say, wait a minute. Why are we paying off these debts? Let's rethink about it. For example, maybe it was a major mistake of the United States government faced with a crisis to solve it by borrowing the money to do so. Maybe that was the point at which to go after those who haven't paid taxes in the past, those with the greatest ability to pay. That would allow the government to raise huge amounts of money to solve a problem, but raise it from the people most close to those responsible for it and not impose it either then or now on the mass of people. It's the basic question, who's going to pay for the mess that was made And we all do know, after all, that investment bankers and AIG Insurance Corporation and executives at GM are the ones who made the decisions that got us into that mess. And it's an interesting question why it's the mass of people's subway rides and school lunches for their kids are the things to be hurt in order to fix this problem, even while those closest to the cause of the problem are faring very nicely. Thank you.
The crisis happens. The banks need to be given a huge amount of money to get out of their problems. Their bad assets brought up. The way that happened is the government borrowed that money by issuing bonds all over the world or wherever in the United States. Institutions bought those bonds.
Right.
And now those institutions are saying, we want our bonds paid off or rolled over, but you have to have the money to pay it.
And you look to be so badly in debt. And the bankers are not stupid. They know there's popular opposition, and they know it's serious. Let's remind, it's not just Greece that has general strikes. I was in France last week. I went to a meeting of all the six national trade union federations. There are six of them in France because they don't agree on very many things. But they were agreeing on this. They were all sitting around the table organizing the general strike that will close everything in France on the 7th of September, which is an act against the Sarkozy government on the question of austerity. And the Railway Workers Union was announcing at the moment that I was at the meeting how everything is arranged, they've taken care of it. The only trains that will move in France on the 7th of September are the trains taking demonstrators from the unions to the various cities with it. You know, this is for Americans to try to understand. They're further along. They've been organized in a different way for a long time. They're different cultures from ours. But the struggle, the banks see this. They see the movement that may make them not get paid back, or maybe not get paid back 100%, a renegotiation like the government is doing with mortgage folks who can't pay their mortgages. You give them a lower rate. You forgive a portion of what they owe. All of that is in the mix for what may be done now, and it isn't an economic question, and it isn't a technical question. This is a political question. Will the pressure rise on the Republicans, Democrats, whoever's in office, to renegotiate this debt with those who've lent the money and say, look, now it's your turn to take it on the chin if we're going to work all this out? It's the old problem of creditor-debtor, but it does raise all these political questions, and in the end, that will make the difference.
Let me ask a question about the G20 that just happened, where Obama went and all the countries are talking about austerity, and Obama is saying something like, don't put that much austerity, don't do that much austerity.
It's just a question of timing. In Europe, because they didn't have the kind of crunch in their society that we did. For example, the increase in unemployment in this country, much larger than what happened in Europe, a much more dramatic impact here on the United States. We don't as a nation like to admit it, and our pundits don't say it, but that is the case. So for the Europeans, they having now managed the crisis in their own minds, I'm not sure they're right, but that's what they think, they're concerned to solve now this debt problem, so they're imposing austerities or trying to. Be aware that what you read in the newspaper are statements by the government about austerity they're planning. They haven't done it yet in most cases, even in Greece. And it's not clear that they'll be able to politically. The new government in Britain, for example, Mr. Cameron, he is making all kinds of statements. But even inside his own coalition of the two parties that run England now, there are an increasing number of what are called backbenchers, the people in Parliament, who don't want what he's doing because they won't get reelected. It'll be a landslide for the Labour Party. As, by the way, there was in the last national election in France, the Sarkozy government, which talks about austerity, hasn't done it yet, lost in 21 out of the 22 departments, that's what they call their states there, in 21 out of the 22 elections, Sarkozy lost. And a coalition of socialists and communists and Greens won. So the political landscape in France is moving very strongly against austerity. So there's a lot of recognition that this kind of crisis is just beginning to hit.
But the Obama issue on that.
I'm sorry, yes, the Obama issue. Obama has two concerns. He hasn't yet gotten to the point where he wants people to think about austerity. And the reason is that works for the Republicans. The Republicans are yelling all the time, gee, the deficit's getting larger. We're going to have to pay that for generations. The usual Republican. He doesn't want to help them. And austerity is very close to saying we oughtn't to have a deficit. We ought to be taking it down. We ought to be paying off our creditors. So he doesn't like that. It does the work of his enemies, number one. Number two, Obama has said that one of the ways out of this crisis for the United States is by an explosion of American exports. That's his hope. And one of the reasons he says that is because there's nothing else he can point to that could get us out of this mess. But in order for exports to happen, the rest of the world has to be in a position to buy. And if our major trading partner, Europe, is going through a big austerity, that means people with higher taxes and lower government spending are not going to be in a position to buy American exports. So it's damaging to America in its hopes of getting out of this crisis that the European – and so he doesn't want them to do that. He wants them to stimulate their economy to make more exports for the United States. So it's an anger of his because he doesn't want to get to this austerity yet. Oh, it's already coming, but he doesn't want to get to it yet. He still has to try to get us out of what hurts us more than the Europeans, which is this enormous problem of unemployment.
Now, Rick, you have a couple of things I want to have you mention. One, you have a book that's relatively recent and your website where we can read more about this.
Yes, I do ask people to go to my website. Everything on there is utterly freely accessible to anybody. All of this is written up. There are articles there about Greece. There are videos and audio tapes and interviews being added all the time. The website address is www.rdwolf.com. So it's www.rdwolf.com. I do invite your listeners to go there because they can follow up anything I've just said and our whole discussion in all kinds of ways there and ways that will be added to literally every day. I'm putting something up there, and I would urge people to do that. The book, which is a compilation of writings, it's all short pieces that are easily understandable, written for a general audience, has the name Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. That's available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and any of the usual ways, or through my website. You can also order it that way.
Rick, is there any country that you would cite as a model of doing things the right way, i.e. going to the corporations, those other organizations, rather than the people?
Actually, the best example I would give you is not a foreign country, but an American state. One state in the United States did something different from all the other 49. And it's worth telling this story because so few Americans know about it. In the summer of 2009, the legislature of the little state of Oregon on the West Coast did something extraordinary. The Democratic Party is the power party there. It has the governorship and it controls both houses of the state legislature. A bill went through that said the following remarkable thing. We face a crisis like every other state, with all these people unemployed and everyone losing their home. The revenues that the state collects are way down, and that means we can't do the usual things. And if we do like our sister state to the south, California, it means raising taxes or cutting government services and employment, and we're not going to do it. We are not going to do it. So how are we going to deal with a $700 million gap over a two-year period? That was the number they dealt with. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to raise taxes on business, and we're going to raise taxes on wealthy people. That's how we're going to solve the problem. And to the amazement of everybody, both houses of the legislature passed the bill. They sent it to the governor, and to the amazement of everyone, the governor signed it. This is now in the late summer of 2009. At that point, because of the laws of the Western states, which allow referendums relatively easily, unlike the East, the Republican Party and the business community were up in arms. This is terrible. This will be the end of civilization and the state of Oregon and all the rest of it. But they found it quite easy to force a referendum. So they gathered signatures. They went through the procedure. They qualified. And I believe it was the end of January or early February of this year, 2010, a referendum was held. 1.2 million citizens of Oregon went to the polls and upheld the law. And so in Oregon, unlike other states, there will be no cutbacks and there will be no taxes on 9/10 of the population. People earning over $250,000 a year saw a significant jump in their income tax rate, and people earning over $500,000, an even bigger one. And businesses were suddenly required to pay. There was a minimum tax was raised. You'll love the minimum tax. The last time a minimum tax was imposed in Oregon was in the last Great Depression, 1931, at the lordly sum of $10 a year. So if you are a corporation, no matter what else you do, a minimum tax of $10 a year. They raised that to $150 a year, which in percentage terms is quite a large sum. But, you know, it's a different mindset. And when the struggle came, when the people of Oregon had to vote, a coalition of community groups, trade unions, and the Democratic Party mobilized as much as they could, the business community Republicans, and it was a clear defeat for the business community Republican, clear win. So the notion that you can do nothing and there's no alternative is disproved, and you don't have to go outside the United States. We have an example here.
Well, terrific. Rick, thank you for being with us.
Thanks,
it's one of the
Rick.
Clearest explanations, the clearest,
yes.
That I've ever had of where we are today.
Okay.
Fabulous, completely fabulous. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.